Vital Transformation recently published comprehensive research on Martian rights. You can download our report for free at our website, vitaltransformation.com. I'm Duane Schultes, the CEO of Vital Transformation, and today I'm joined by two of my colleagues in our Grumpy Old Men podcast series, and they are, as always, Dr. Joe Hamming, VT's U.S. Business Director and a card-carrying neuroscientist. Good morning, Joe. How are you?
Good morning, Duane. Good morning, Harry.
Always good to see you, Joe. And Dr. Harry Bowen has been introduced by Joe, VT's consulting economist and a professional purveyor of common sense and often very grumpy. How are you doing, Harry?
Good morning, everyone.
You don't sound terribly grumpy yet, Harry.
No, not yet, but I'm working on it.
Okay, we'll get you a coffee. Martian writes, on December 8th, 2023, the Biden administration, under the National Institute of Standards and Technology, NIST released a draft interagency guidance framework for considering the exercise of Martian rights in the Bayh-Dole Act. Now, that's a lot of legislative mumbo-jumbo, but ultimately, what we're saying here is there's something called Martian rights relative to a law called Bayh-Dole. Joe, what are Martian rights in the context of the Bayh-Dole Act?
So, Martian rights represent a codicil, if you will, within the Bayh-Dole legislation. What they wanted to be sure happened is that the intellectual property, when licensed to an entity like an industry player, they wanted to be sure that it didn't sit on the shelf within that entity. So in other words, if you took a license for a therapy, took a license for whatever intellectual property you were interested in, you couldn't sit on it. You couldn't put it on the shelf and make sure that others couldn't compete with you. So it was a way for them to make sure that whoever was licensing the technology would actually run with it.
It was exploited.
It was exploited, exactly, to make sure that it's exploited. And they had the ability to come back in. That's why they call it March in. It's nothing to do with the month of the year, nothing like that. It allows them to
beware
come
of
back.
The Ides of March in.
That's right. Yes. They could come back and grab it, make it available for another industrial entity to then exploit the product.
So it made sure that if a company licensed this stuff, they wouldn't sit on it, poach it, not utilize it, block competitors.
I think it goes to the idea of, that they've invented a battery that lasts forever, but they're withholding it from the market so that they can continue to sell batteries that don't last forever.
Right.
So it's that kind of idea. That's my understanding of it. So it's to, ensure that the holder of a patent or the intellectual property does not withhold it from the market in order to protect some other position they might have.
Essentially, Martian rights have been there forever and ever. And then in the 90s, you start getting these academics who start writing articles saying, hey, well, we don't like the price of drugs. Government actually funded this stuff, so we should get them for free. So we can start using Martian rights to basically take these patents back and offer them to other people. Now, Harry, from your perspective as an economist, why was the system that the government had for sort of sitting on patents inefficient? Why did this not work?
Well, I suspect that the government is not very good at commercialization.
How dare you, Harry?
What is their incentive? I think they were more interested, really, in the funding of basic research, and they didn't really think about the idea of commercialization. That's not their business. Their business was to fund basic research. And by the structure of how things work, they retained the intellectual property, and therefore they never used it. And that's why the Bayh-Dole Act is so important, is it transferred property rights in that IP to entities that would be able to develop it and use it, or would be willing to develop it
right.
and use it. So it was a major shift and an excellent example of the assignment of property rights. Typically, when government controls something, the property rights, while the government may own it, their economic incentives are just not there, not the same as occurs within the context of a private market.
So the idea that an individual academic who invents something, who has a novel invention, can then monetize it
right.
Seems to have been hugely successful.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, if we look at the developments and the innovation that's taken place over the last 20, 30 years, right?
What's intriguing to me, Joe, I mean, you obviously worked in industry for many years. You were a bench scientist. How often through your career did you see personally, did you deal with academic research and where you were working in collaboration with a research institute? Neurology is notoriously difficult. I'm sure you had some research partnerships in your days at BMS when you were a bench scientist in neurology.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Industry has long sought subject matter experts, expertise in model development, expertise in animal behavior, that this is a very important part of course, of the neurosciences. So we held multiple relationships with academics across the country.
We have this situation where there's these march-in provisions. Everyone gets clever and says, okay, we can start using these to take back patents. And none of them have ever been approved. Everyone sort of had this idea that march-in rights, it would seem, would never be used. Now, all of a sudden, on December 8th, the Biden administration releases this guidance, not under the NIH, not under the administration itself, not under the Department of Health, but in the National Institute of Standards and Technology, NIST, this rather obscure thing. I do find that odd. Why do we think that they parked this in an interdisciplinary committee under NIST, this very obscure division of the Department of Commerce?
You hit the nail on the head. It's commerce.
Yeah.
So this is an arm of commerce. It does make a fair amount of sense if you wanted to collaborate, if government wants to collaborate between health and human services and commerce when you're talking about products, potential products, therapies that are going to come from federally funded research, of course, through the process of licensing from government to the biopharmaceutical industry, for instance. So that seems rather logical, actually. And the people at NIST, you know, would probably argue about being called
obscure,
but just want to make that.
If any of them want to sit down and record a podcast over this, we'd be happy to have a discussion. So
absolutely.
So Harry, from your experience, because you did work for the government for a while
in the Department of Labor,
have you seen these sort of large groups looking at these issues before? How common is this?
Well, what I did, that was my first job out of graduate school. So it was most of that was above my pay grade at that time. So I can't really comment on that. But actually, as a slight segue into something very quick, I think another thing to think about with the Bayh-Dole Act and that is how it's also transformed the whole biopharmaceutical sector.
Sure.
And the way things get done. And I think it's possible that our listeners may not realize what the impact has been when suddenly these academics can retain intellectual property relative to the amount of R&D that used to take place within quote-unquote big pharma.
Right.
And I think a lot of people don't understand that. They still tend to think of, you know, a lot of R&D taking place in the context of large pharmaceutical firms. And while there still is R&D, the whole bioecosystem, as I've learned working with you and Joe, is radically different than that vision of what it looks like. So I wanted to just kind of, again, segue slide a bit.
Do we like the fact that the government is funding this stuff? I mean, do we like the fact that we have this public-private partnership? Is it effective?
Well, it's been hugely effective in bringing new therapies to the market and all kinds of innovations. The rest of the world looks at our innovation ecosystem with a great deal of envy. There's no question about that. Other countries are beginning and or have over the years adopted something like it. Of course, their systems of government are very much different, but they recognize that this is a great thing. The main thing is that the government needs to make this available and then facilitate the transfer to the biopharmaceutical entity in this case, and to make sure that they're successful and to stay out of the way.
Right.
That's been a theme of much of the conversations that we've had, the three of us,
right,
is I think Harry puts it, staying in their lane, which really applies here, because if an entity like a biopharmaceutical company is going to be successful, they can't have interference that is non-commercial that is going to hamstring them from moving forward as quickly as possible. Because once you patent something, a product patent, a composition of matter patent, the clock starts ticking. You don't have forever.
20 years.
That's correct. And if you're wasting a year or two, what you're doing is you're eating into the back end of the revenues that you're hoping to get, if you're lucky to get at the end of the patent cycle.
Harry, you have competing ideas around government-funded innovation. If you look at, say, Japan in the 70s, which is often put up as a model, when China now, large bureaucratic directing institutions which control a lot of the targeted R&D. They set up these grand national plans, and then they do these sort of big macro government. The French government does a lot of this too. The U.S. has had a much more bottom-up approach to innovation. Are you concerned that we're seeing a move generally trying to push more top-down government-led control? I mean, say, for example, look at some of the legislation that occurred within the Inflation Reduction Act related to how we're almost forcing large macroeconomic changes into the energy sector and in the automobile sector. How does the Bayh-Dole Act and sort of this bottom-up innovation compare with the top-down?
We can look across the world, as you sort of were suggesting, in different countries and so-called industrial policies, if you want to think of it that way. And industrial policies are usually a failure. they really are. They are. I mean, I teach economics, international business in my other job, and
your day job, your square job,
my whatever. And the thing is that we have a number of case studies and textbook descriptions of grandiose schemes like semiconductors in Japan, which they spent billions of yen on and ultimately failed and all went to South Korea.
Yeah.
As I have been recently remarking to my students, even though they don't want to hear me say it, I expect that as soon as the money is turned off for all of the semiconductor and other manufacturing plans that have gone forward under the Biden administration, as soon as that spigot goes off, most of this stuff will disappear. Because it's not economically viable without government subsidies. And it's not like you're going to have an infant industry that will grow up somehow that needed this kind of nurturing support in the early stage, and then it will be a competitive powerhouse, you know, into the future. No, nothing's really changed in the world. We're just subsidizing this activity, and that's why now it looks like a great deal. So get in and get the money while you can, and I suspect it will all collapse in 5 years.
One of your great sayings when you were lecturing, in full disclosure, Harry was one of my professors for economics back in the day. If you want more of something, subsidize it. If you want less of something, tax it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no. And so I think, as Joe said, I mean, that the comment about stay in the lane and that, I think that the U.S. Partly be through the Bayh-Dole, and quite frankly, up until, you know, fairly recently, last 15 years, maybe less, property rights are something that have been enshrined in this country. And increasingly, they are trying to be torn down.
Yeah.
And this is goes in many different directions, philosophy and politics and these kinds of things. But it's incredibly dangerous. And I think that many of the things that we talk about and the issues that the firm is dealing with and this kind of stuff is really, really ultimately fighting against this loss of intellectual property.
And speaking of IP, you know, when we did this analysis to determine the scope of the potential impact of this review that was done by NIST on Marchin rights, we did analyze over 350 drugs. We used a tool called the Lens, which allowed us to very surgically go in and look for this government interest statement, which defines research and patents. If you have a patent that was funded by the government, you have to put in a government interest statement by law. There's about 2 or 3% that don't have it, fine. So we're only 97% accurate, I'll take it. But the reality is, when we looked at this, there is a contradiction here that we do need to discuss, because whilst we have 10% of our drugs did have a government interest statement associated to one of their patents, it was only 10%. So 90% of the innovation, 90% of the patent portfolio that we had, which you're talking thousands and thousands of patents, I think it was close to 3,000 patents, a small sliver of that 10% that had a government interest statement at all in the composition of matter and mechanism of action patents. Now, this is really important. So, Joe, what are composition of matter and mechanism of action patents, and why are they important?
Well, if you look at the way that, you know, medicine starts in the case of the biopharmaceutical industry, what a company will do is based on literature, based on reviews of literature and chemistry, they'll look at like families of molecules that have proven to get into the body and cross the blood-brain barrier in a case of the neurosciences, for instance. What they can do then is they will produce an array of like molecules and then begin testing them for their bioavailability and their toxicity and their ability to hit individual targets that they're hoping to get. In that initial testing, they will identify several, for instance, three or maybe in a case like this of a family of molecules, they'll say, we're gonna file a patent on these. That would be a composition of matter patent or a product patent. It's then going to be tested further, first in animals and in large animals, and then in human beings, to make sure that it's distributed throughout the body the way that they wanted to or needed to. And then, as they begin to get closer to, you know, full-scale trials and all in humans, they have to manufacture it. So they're product by and process patents that are related, but having a patent on a molecule isn't enough. You have to be able to manufacture. You have to be able to make it safe. You have to tweak it, for to use a technical term, to to make it bioavailable,
scalable,
safe, and certainly scalable. That's the difference, and that's why there's never a medicine that comes to market that's got one patent. It's got this whole family of patents that protects the core molecule and its derivatives. And it protects the manufacturing process. And then there can be other add-ons that make it last longer. And then the bioavailability might be longer. It might be really beneficial for it to stick around in the body for a long period of time, like an antibiotic, for instance. Or it may be very important for it to clear quickly.
Right.
So they have, those are all parts of modifications that are made to the patent family to protect and allow an entity to continue to sell, market, and reap the benefits, financial benefits, over a set period of time.
Harry and I published an article where we'd done it the other way, not look at the products and the patents. We'd started from the NIH grants. This is going back 3 years ago now. It's, you know, a very well-cited article. But what was interesting in that is we looked at the IP that was created out of the NIH and then saw the applicability and approvals to see what the ratio was and how much it really took to actually get one drug, basically. And it was, we looked at 22,000 patents and found 14 approvals. So it's, you know, not a lot there. What was intriguing, though, is, for example, we found a patent for an epidermal patch, you know, sort of a sticky patch for the skin. That was used, it was an NIH patent that was used in like three or four different drugs, one for antimenopausal treatment, one for smoking cessation. It was just, it was weird stroke of luck, I guess, or an oddity, a statistical oddity, where we found this patent that was multi-applicable across several different drugs in our portfolio. It's like, wow, that's kind of weird. But that patent had nothing to do with the actual drug.
Right, it was a post-it note patent.
Exactly. It was a delivery device. Yeah. You know, Harry, from our perspective here, looking at this problem, somewhere between 6 and 10% is pretty common from a lot of the literature that says, okay, about 10% of all the patents come from the government. From your perspective as an economist, is that showing a failure of the system, or is the system working well?
Again, I think people tend to specialize in what they do well. And we have a much wider pool of people that are working in these areas. There's only a certain number of employees at the National Institutes of Health. I think they also have other things that they do in monitoring activities and things like that. So I don't think they have the time And they're not relatively better at doing it than scientists in the private sector and universities and this kind of thing. So I think they're there as a kind of secondary or primary support, really, in the idea of helping primary research. If somebody can't find funding from someplace else, it can also look good to an academic if they get an NIH grant, because there's overhead that filters into the university, and that gives them a chance to get tenure or to get a bigger lab or to do whatever power they might want to build within their little fiefdom. I know academics.
Well, you are one. You play one on television.
I play one on television. But yeah, I think it's really thing. I think it's a good example of relative or comparative advantage. You know, that people specialize in doing what they do well, and sometimes you can get some. You know, Friday and Caruso can both work together on a given Saturday to collect coconuts and go fishing, but otherwise they tend to specialize in what they do best. And I think that kind of the respect that the United States traditionally has had in terms of the idea of intellectual property and these things has had the idea that the government is not a heavy hand in the activities of what the private sector is doing. And that's changing.
Yeah.
With recent legislations, that's changing.
I guess to cut to the chase now, when we looked at these 350 drugs, 363 in fact, only five had all the patents where the mechanism of action and composition of matter had a government interest statement, were related to government research. So, I mean, that's a pretty darn low percentage, to say the least. It came as quite a surprise to us. So how do we square this circle? We're saying that the NIH is vital to research. We believe that. We know that this research filters down and has an impact across de-risking new technologies and new platforms. But yet, when it came right down to it, all of this rhetoric, all this highfalutin, jumping up and down, pulling their hair and threatening to eat worms about pricing and the utilization of Marchand rights, et cetera, it really just came down to five drugs. Of those five drugs, two were imaging agents developed in Australia off U.S. patents. One company sold for $1 million. That means it had less than $100,000 a year in revenue in VC circles. I mean, basically, it's not a high-value product. No. I don't think you'd be marching in on it. So those two assets are basically non-existent. We had two cancer therapies, one of which had no sales at all in any record we found. One stopped having any revenue generated in 2019. So again, these are products that are essentially withdrawn, that are, you know, you could march in on them, but why would you? Because they're not in circulation. And the final drug was, as everybody knows, and everything's been written about in the last 10 years, was Xtandi, the Pfizer drug produced in partnership with the DOD and UCLA.
Right. And of course, Astellas.
And Astellas, absolutely, who's one of the sponsors of our research. Thank you, Astellas.
That's correct. So I think we need to come back to the whole march-in issue. Bayh-Dole had this codicil, if you will, this provision within to make sure that the government could come back and take the intellectual property back. We've covered that. This has been spurred on because our government, many advocacy organizations, etc., are trying to use the march-in provision as a way of gaining access because of the cost of a medicine.
Right.
So it's, in other words, it's a blunt force instrument to price control drugs. I know through all of our conversations, there was an expectation, there is an expectation in many of our elected officials in this country that there's a wide variety of medicines that are march-inable.
Yeah, for lack of a better word, yes.
Yes. I mean, I've even a lot of experts use that term, yes. March-inable.
With a lot of hyphens, but yes.
Yeah. But the point is that, you know, the research that we did just laid that bare. It was just crystal clear that it is not a viable mechanism. It's not even a fair mechanism. It wasn't the way that the law was written. It is not the way that Bayh-Dole intended this to be. And we know this now because many of those who've been crying loudest about using march-in to price control have thrown in the towel, conceded, well, it's...
I wouldn't even say conceded. I'd say they're backpedaling furiously. Well,
backpedaling would be, okay, I'll give you that.
Yeah, backpedaling. Face.
Backpedaling. Face. Just, so that's really telling. That is very telling to me because nobody did the careful analysis.
Well, it's hard. Well,
until Vital Transformation did.
I think, well, obviously, they kept harping on Xtandi.
Yeah.
Okay. Every time for the last 10 years, Elizabeth Warren in March and a cadre of senators wrote a letter to Secretary Becerra saying we should march in on Xtandi. Now, I take this quite personally. My father's being kept alive now on Xtandi. He has metastatic prostate cancer. So this is a fight that I kind of did roll up my sleeves and probably punched a little harder than I normally do. You know, I found this just quite offensive, just on a personal level, because this drug does keep people alive effectively. And it's the only one that the activists have been saying, which means somebody... Now, we use this brand new data set called the Lens, this new tool, this very surgical tool that allows you to search millions and millions of patents for that government interest statement. Now, this didn't exist more than 36 months ago when we started doing this work or talking about it. So that means beforehand, the reason why they kept pummeling Xtandi, someone somewhere had paid an extraordinarily large amount for a manual search on all these drugs. And they were operating from the point that you couldn't do this work without expending an enormous amount of resources. And we just stumbled onto a new tool in partnership with the Law Library at the University of Wisconsin. Again, we're always very grateful for their support on this project, because we would not have been able to do so. And we sort of uncovered, there's no there, I think, is the parlance in the proletariat.
Took the words right out of my mouth.
And again, we can think what we want, but the experts, I'm using,
quote unquote,
I'm using air quotes, the experts that have been harping at this have already conceded this point.
Yeah.
And that lays out a sort of a very interesting strategy that we're working on now with other, you know, potential.
Yeah, because we're detecting a pivot. But before we start talking about that pivot, yep. I do think we need to stress a little bit more and dig into this Xtandi issue a bit. Because, yep. Okay, there is a blockbuster drug there. Xtandi is marchinable. By all definition, it is. Let's just say in a peak of bureaucratic fetishism between now and the election. Harry, what happens if they do this?
Well, I'm going to object to your term that it is marchinable.
Yes.
Because
I second that.
I don't think it is marchinable. It is marchinable in the sense that
they could do it.
They could, but the question is what are they marching in to do?
Right.
And actually, under Bayh-Dole, as I understand it, legalese interpretation of a few words in there that has to do with, and Joe, and you can help me out here, that it could be marchinable in order to provide the reasonable access to the drug. And the question becomes, what does reasonable access mean?
Yeah.
And as we understood it, and who was the gentleman that...
Joe Allen. Joe Allen's been very articulate on this.
Who has talked with you and us and stuff and given us lots of insight into the creation of that act.
And we should add that Joe Allen is the president of the Bayh-Dole Coalition. He worked with Birchbaugh in developing the legislation. He is the living expert and resource on this, an encyclopedic knowledge of the legislative history. And the man deserves a ton of credit, and I'll be doing a podcast with him catching up. Yeah. So please continue.
So again, the idea was that we don't want the partner that has the patent to withhold the drug from the market. Had nothing to do with pricing.
Exactly.
So there's this, you know, shady interpretation of language, and that's, I guess, what the courts decide. But that's why I don't agree that it's marchinable.
But if you look at this administration, look at student loans, look at what happened with OSHA during COVID, look at what's happening with the Missouri First Amendment cases with Jay Bhattacharya and Martin Kulldorff. Okay, we've seen extrajudicial activity of this administration that has been overturned again and again in the Supreme Court. This does not necessarily mean they won't try it.
Right. I would agree with that. But I think they would fail. I think they will fail.
I do as well, and I certainly hope so. The term that comes to mind is overreach.
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
It's not, and again, as you pointed out, it is OSHA. It is, we won't get into the politics of this. I'm sorry, but
of course
there
we
are
will.
Many. many, many examples of overreach. So I want to go back to the point that Harry made as well about whether Xtandi is marginable. Just from an investment standpoint and a fairness standpoint, if you look at the amount of money that went into these grants to academic institutions that led to Xtandi, the amount of money is just absolutely dwarfed by what is spent by the company to actually make the product as widely available as it is. It's a lot like if you're going to invest in something, whatever it is. I put a dollar in. You put in $1,000 or $10,000. Who's taking more risk?
Oh, but your dollar's more important, according to...
and in fact, I would say my dollar is not very important at all.
Yeah.
And but
this
again,
is no different than shareholders.
Yes, that's right. And so you can salute the intellectual property protections afforded by the investment that the federal government has made in these things, and at the same time recognize that it is insufficient, is grossly insufficient in getting a product to the marketplace. That's it. And so what does this do? What would happen if MarchIn is utilized on Xtandi? And never mind, of course, Duane, we've talked about this over and over again. In a few years, it's off patent and it's going to be a generic product. That's should also come into this conversation, and is a very, very important aspect to the story. But what is going to happen if they do march in on this? It's going to chill investment with future medicines. That is, why license from the federal government if you feel as though they're going to come in and interfere with your ability to recoup your R&D expense someplace down the road? And it's the camel's nose on... We're using a lot of metaphors.
Yeah, I know. We're always using metaphors.
The camel's nose would be under the tent. And it's hard to imagine that the whole body won't be in before too long. That's the greatest fear. And that's the fear that we're hearing from investors, from VCs. Certainly technology transfer offices at major universities, they all see this as a potential threat to future innovation.
Well, we had conversations last week in D.C., and we're already hearing from several people that they are seeing people, our VCs are being more concerned, and there is a pullback from exposure to MarchIn patents in portfolios, and there's a change now that's occurring. There's already been a rollback and a cooling. Now, can we show it statistically? I don't know. But we're hearing through the grapevine that portfolio managers are already starting to get cold feet about looking at some of this stuff.
They don't like losing money.
No. No. Well, one would think they wouldn't. I mean, again, the government seems to excel at it. But
Well, also, there's a kind of vagueness to the whole thing, too, right? I mean, we haven't really had, in a legal sense, the debate about what does this march in actually entitled the government to do.
Right.
And how would the courts come down in terms of what they could get? That, by the way, the fact that Xtandi is going to go off patent, that hasn't stopped the Biden administration from also going after drugs that are going off patent under the IRA. They don't follow their own rules, as I think we found recently.
The damage in some ways has kind of occurred. People are getting cold feet. We've had a series of academics who have basically built castles on this issue. We've had government officials who have built political careers on this issue. Why did they get it so wrong? Was this intentional? Did they know it was so limited? Or was this just they never thought they'd be called out on it?
Probably a little of both.
Is it a question of incentives, Harry? There's more political gain to be made, stoking political...
It's a different ideology. It's a different ideology. The ideology now is the government knows best. It's that kind of ideology. And they're basically trying to exert control and power.
Yeah, I think what's happening is there has been a shift over the last couple of decades in how people view the biopharmaceutical industry. The cost of many of these very innovative new products is quite high. There's fatigue as far as the pricing on a lot of medicines. That has been driven a lot by the niche products that they are.
The science has been leading that way with genetic medicine.
It's inexorably towards a narrower indication, which means narrower market, which means fewer patients. And fewer patients means
higher prices.
Higher prices because of low revenues. But those drugs still cost on average billions. That you can argue about whether it's a billion per drug or two or three, but the cost of developing this so that it's safe and effective is still very high. If you have to recoup R&D, your R&D expense, that means that the cost is going to be higher. Do we sacrifice those sorts of new innovations and not develop them?
Well, the IRA would probably say yes. That's what we're starting to see a pull away from those.
That's exactly the case. And I think it all comes down to this overreach.
Yeah.
It's clear that there's a willingness to overstep. There's a willingness to manipulate and to control things. And I think that's a dangerous path.
Well, let's be honest. The academics, and I'm not going to name names now, but I mean, anyone can look at my Twitter feed because I did have a bit of fun when we released the study. The reality is they're not going to pay a political price for being wrong for 10 years. There's no political price for them. Meanwhile, they've been putting a multi-billion-dollar industry at risk with rhetoric that is basically fraudulent, borderline slanderous. You know, I don't know. Right. If, you know, it's ridiculous. I mean, the data is so overwhelming. You know, even if we found 10 drugs, I mean, still, it's such a minute percentage of the overall drug population of a novel new therapies. It's absurd. It's an absurdity.
It's all part of somehow a movement toward a lack of responsibility.
Exactly.
The truth.
Lack of accountability.
So we want to point out that these are the bad people. They're price gouging. They're doing this. They're doing this. And I think this is just part of a general method of an ideology that has unfortunately grown in this country, antithetical to the foundings of the United States of America and the system of private property rights.
Yeah. IP patents are property.
Right.
It's intellectual property.
Of course, you know, you didn't build that.
But I think, Duane, if we go back to this really important question, when you look at a big thorny problem like this, getting innovative new therapies to people who need them to continue innovation so that the unmet medical needs in this society are met over time. Those who are pushing hardest to limit this innovation through price controls and all kinds of other mechanisms won't pay a price. They won't be in office, for instance. The world will not remember the manipulation and the lies and the misrepresentations and that many academics who are anti-industry, they will just fade away and their efforts to hurt the industry will be forgotten. The people who are paying the price, it's not the companies. Yes, they pay some price, but it's the people who need these therapies that are going to end up paying the price for the lack of innovation.
Because the academics now are going to find that there's going to be fewer deals because companies aren't going to be willing to take the risk just by the mere fact that we're even discussing
this. Fewer deals means fewer ideas that are brought forward, which means there are fewer therapies in the future. Absolutely.
What's interesting, Peter Kolchinsky, the well-known venture capitalist who's been very forward on protesting many aspects of the Inflation Reduction Act. We had a podcast last month that's done thousands and thousands of downloads and thousands of hits on social media. It's done.
Great conversation.
It blew up. But he said something about this March-in decision, this NIST proposal to actually review Marchand rights. He said, and I'm going to quote him, "When you see a party proposing to waive patents, you know they're out of ideas. They're just pandering to the voters in the worst possible way." Peter's a Harvard academic, Boston. I mean, I'm assuming he's not a Trumpian, you know, MAGA Republican, hardly. And when he's saying, look, this is bankrupt. There's nothing here. Are they just going to keep hitting left, right, and center until people like Peter finally roll up the towel and say, I'm done. I'm just going to go invest in AI?
These kinds of institutional investors, they're really allergic to losing money. They will not continue to pour money into a dry hole or dry holes. They will go where they can get a return on an investment because that's what they're expected to do. That's what they have to do. Otherwise, that money dries up. You don't have to develop medicines. If you have a pot of money, you can go after AI or games or
apps.
Or apps.
Yeah.
You know, the latest and greatest shopping app on your iPhone or Android. It's just start investing in other parts of the world. That's the part that frightens me the most, is that if investments begin to or continue to be made elsewhere, we should be we want to see all countries make investments, but not at the expense of the United States. I think we have separated ourselves. It's very clear from the work that we've done over the last few years where innovation comes from. We've talked about this on other podcasts. The United States is the top of the heap.
Yeah.
And we have the opportunity to lose that position through bad public policy.
You know, Harry, we pulled some data before Christmas when the CBO had gone on and said there's no impact from the Inflation Reduction Act. And again, you and I were sort of incredulous about that. And so I pulled some data out of PitchBook. And in the process of seeing that there has been a 70% drop in IPOs since the introduction of the Build Back Better agenda, which you and I worked on that analysis, 38% of VCs disappeared from deal making in 2023. That's a staggering statistic to me. 2 out of 5 are gone. Why? Why is this happening, Harry?
I think for the reasons Joe was talking about, the dangers of, in the context of the margin, the venture capitalists are seeing the handwriting on the wall. And they're saying that the returns in this sector that are being impacted by the IRA are much riskier now, and probably are just not willing to invest. We have lots of different little areas of evidence of that, and I think we're going to look even more at some of the issues that arise out of the IRA and the negative impacts that it has. You know, news has arrived, and investors thrive on news, and when news change, they change their behavior based on how they think that's going to affect things in the future. So I think they evidently don't see this as a very bright spot in the future in terms of, you know, their willingness to undertake investments in the biopharmaceutical sector.
Are you surprised that the CBO is digging in their heels saying that we see no evidence of a decline in investments?
Yeah, this is a bit puzzling. I know that we've spoken with the CBO, and you did in particular. And I think they're being a little hazy on this. I think they're thinking without seeing the data. We looked at the data. You in particular looked at the data and found this. And so the data does not coincide with what the CBO would like us to think.
Well, their position was, well, since the passage of IRA, we see no evidence of a decline.
But anybody that read the legislation and saw increasingly that it was going to pass would already anticipate this.
Smart money for a reason. You don't sit around and wait to get smacked in the face.
You know, we do what are called event studies, right? we want to see, did this merger add value to a company? And we look at months before the actual merger, because usually that's where all the activity takes place. So to think that suddenly on the date that it shows up in the Federal Register, that's only when people learn about it is, of course, ridiculous.
Yeah.
They learn about it sooner, and they pay people to try to find out this stuff sooner, right?
It's called
inside information in a sense. It's the whole topic of what we're kind of discussing today in terms of margin rights and the government doing this. I think the elephant in the room is the desire of government to take over and control. This is a danger. And it's funny because it's incredibly populist. I mean, I think of this, there's a chicken in every pot. I think that was something. So, you know, this administration would like a free drug in everybody's medicine cabinet. it's just unrealistic to think you can do that. But again, it's populist. So this is purely political.
Patrick Kilbride at the U.S. Chamber a couple of years ago said something which I thought was brilliant. It's like, if you want drugs to be free, that's easy. Just don't invent any new ones.
Yeah.
The European Union is lost its edge. It is no longer a player, a real player on a global scale. It is working to further hamstring itself. And what I have said so many times, Duane, in our meetings in Washington, is all we have to do is follow their lead. We could continue to do all of the ruinous things, the bad policy prescriptions, and we will too look like the European Union. Innovation is dying. It is not happening. New company creation is not happening.
I tell you, that number is so scary, Joe. I mean, it was interesting I will put this out there. Harry and I built a really interesting model that's extremely accurate, very robust. And it spit out 11 companies being created. It modeled 11 companies being created in 2023. Now, Harry and I looked at each other and said, damn, we've got a data problem. There's something not right here. That can't be. We went into PitchBook and then pulled 2023 and European EU 27 biotech creation. It wasn't 11, it was 13.
You know, huge.
Huge increase. I mean, well, it's 20%. I mean, the idea that PitchBook, the definitive source for venture capital funding and, you know, and startups and everything, is accounting for 13 companies in 2023. Now, it's possible there may be some registration that's missing. There may be some more that flowed in Q1. So maybe let's say there's another five or six companies. Still, 18 companies.
It's devastating.
One less than a country. One fewer company than countries. We can go back to 2014 and see 120, 140 being created a year. It's staggering to me.
Yeah. I think that just underscores the idea of, if you think something that you're doing now is going to work, look into history. And history tells us that this basic direction that our government has taken is doomed to fail. It fail in the sense that, again, I'll use the word populist, we're going to spread free drugs to everybody, we're going to do this, and we're going to end up ruining this country, at least in the biopharmaceutical sector. You can look at the history of the EU. It defies the basic laws of economics, and it's just not going to work. It's not going to work.
Joe, what do you think happens with this Marchand proposal going forward?
I hope it dies.
Well, I've spent a good part of yesterday reading the unbelievably well-done piece from Bio, 12, 13 pages responding to the interagency working group.
Which quotes quite a bit from our research.
Only a lot, yeah. And yes. And it's prominently linked there, as well as the paper, your paper from Regulatory...
Innovation and Regulatory Science. Yes.
So Joe Allen's excellent letter as well from the Bayh-Dole Coalition, terrific, so well laid out, so well describes the folly, the road that they would be going down to do this. There are letters from members of Congress on both sides of the aisle that are cautioning against this. I believe, I'm really optimistic, I'm very hopeful that this is not going to go forward. And time will tell, but I'm very hopeful.
We'll get those Bernie Sanders bread lines, but we can call them drug lines. And the good thing about drug lines is at the end of the line, you get drugs.
You get drugs.
So can I make one more point before I know we're getting close to the end here? This is something that we discussed this past week in Washington. I've made this point before, not on our podcast, but for our listeners and for anyone who's really interested in this innovation and anyone who becomes a patient and needs cancer therapy, a new neuroscience drug, something to fight off whatever you're fighting. People, I don't think they view drugs the way that they should. Somehow or other in these conversations, we never hear the critics of the industry concede that medicines are not simply a cost in healthcare. They reduce costs as well. In vaccines, you don't get sick at all. a drug that keeps them out of the hospital, shortens hospital stays, etc., extends their life, blood pressure or cholesterol inhibitor. These things need to be taken into account, that without drugs, without medicines, we'd live shorter lives and we'd be in the hospital much more. And those kinds of costs just have to be taken into account.
Unfortunately, those calculations are notoriously difficult to do.
Yeah, and I was going to say, I mean, we have this HTA boogeyman that potentially could be invoked, and we wouldn't want to, you know, encourage that too much. That is the idea of looking at a strict cost-benefit kind of calculation. There are too many vagaries of assumptions that can go into that. Joe's point is, of course, spot on. We tend to look at what you have to lay out of your wallet in order to buy the drug. But in the aggregate, you want to look at the benefits that are resulting from that. But the idea of taking it to the level of life years and this kind of calculation, I think, is very dangerous.
It's also a proxy for the actual cost, because you don't actually know with a quali what the actual often deferred costs are. For example, in the context of a quali for the first time treatments for Alzheimer's disease, which we have discussed on this podcast on numerous occasions, the fact is they're 33% effective at reducing the impact of the disease. If you have a 1/3 reduction in the need to have someone stay at home and stop working and can stay in the workforce and attend to an aged relative, that is a good thing, one would think, and that is a real cost savings. We don't account for that. And some of these new cardiovascular drugs that are rolling out that are going to drop obesity, man, the long-term, cardiovascular is still the number one killer in this country.
Yeah, and I think also just the idea is, I understand HTA type analysis, and that is, you know, it's a snapshot. It's based on only what we know now, and we don't really know a lot of the benefits, and that is, you're suggesting, what if by giving a particular drug, 3 years later, you've learned something about how that drug is or isn't effective, and it leads to a new drug. But before that, the HTA authority said, well, this is not cost effective. It doesn't increase life years, and therefore, we're not going to authorize this drug.
This is the situation that happened with Herceptin, the breast cancer drug. They initially said, this is not cost effective. Now, the reason why that got overturned is because, fortunately, 51% of the electorate are women, and they took great offense to that. And so it became a political issue. Which just goes to show that often the HTA decision is a political decision anyway.
Yes.
And this is the problem.
That's why you take it out of the political domain.
We did a podcast with William Smith from the Pioneer Institute in Boston. This is about a year ago. He'd just written a book about it, the history of the HTA system. A very interesting conversation. And he points out something which I found fascinating, which I'm surprised no drug company has taken up yet, particularly related to some of the neurological drugs. If you do something within the context of the American with Disabilities Act, which increases the likelihood that they will end up in an institution by lacking care, that violates the ADA. Mm. So now what CMS's decisions that they've been doing around a lot of these Alzheimer's drugs potentially violate the ADA.
Yeah.
Now, I'm surprised no one's taken that up, but I mean, there's something there. Mm-hmm. I'm surprised. I mean, there's obviously something there, because there's no question that there's a violation.
Yeah.
It certainly sounds like it to me.
It certainly, yeah, and you're a neurologist, so I trust you.
Neuroscientist,
sorry. Yeah. Card carrying. Again, our study, Marchin Rights Under the Bayh-Dole Act and NIH Contribution to Pharmaceutical Patents, is available on our website, vitaltransformation.com. We're extremely grateful for the support of Bio, Merck, Astellas, Pfizer, Gilead, the National Pharmaceutical Council, Sanofi, and Novartis, allowing us to do that work. It was quite impactful. We released it 6 days before the NIST report came out, and it caused a little bit of trouble, and that was quite fun, I have to admit.
Good timing.
So again, I'd like to thank my colleagues, Dr. Joe Hamming. Joe, always great to see you.
Great. Thank you, Duane. It's great to be with you guys today.
Dr. Harry Bowen, always a pleasure to see you.
Thank you, gentlemen. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thanks for listening, everyone. Have a good day. The executive producer of the Vital Health Podcast is Duane Schultes. Our editor is Mark Brodeen. Our project manager is Gwen O'Loughlin. The Vital Health Podcast is a production of Vital Transformation, LLC, copyright 2024.